It's Mark Yeagy here, wealth architect and lifestyle investor. Let's take your life to the next level. Welcome to the Wealth Architect Podcast.
Hey, everybody, it's Mark Yeagy. Welcome to another edition of the Wealth Architect Podcast. Glad you're here. Today, we have a really fun guest. Seems like it so far. Anyway, I'm just going to read you his bio because it's pretty cool. Today's guest is Luis Belmonte. He's a highly experienced real estate developer with over 40 years of experience. As a principal at Seven Hills Property, he specializes in retail, multifamily, and industrial developments across California, Oregon, and Nevada. He was founding partner and executive VP at AMB Property Corporation, which is now known as Prologis. You may know them as a large REIT, where he spearheaded major global projects. He's also a U.S. Navy veteran. Thank you for your service, by the way. And an accomplished author of Real Estate 101, Street Dog MBA, and Street Dog Negotiator. He's here to share his insights into real estate, business strategy, and negotiation. I'm looking forward to this really cool conversation with Luis. Welcome, Luis. How are you?
Great. How are you?
I am fantastic. Tell us a little bit about what you're doing now and how you got started in this business. I know a lot of us have twists and turns that lead us on our journey, but I'm sure yours has some pretty cool stories.
Well, in my declining years, I look back at all the forks in the road and all the accidents that happened, and it's really a marvelous journey. And some blind alleys, some wading upstream through rivers of you know what, a hard experience, and but a whole lot of fun. And I have to say, in summary, that I feel extremely grateful for having found a way to make a living that I enjoy so much. I do it in my old age for giggles. I'm just a deal junkie. I love to do deals, and I still do them. Right now, I have a younger partner who's energetic, and we have low-income housing, we have one little industrial deal, and we have neighborhood retail in Oregon. And they're all very different businesses that, in effect, we got into accidentally as opportunities presented themselves, and all of them are going just fine. We have, fortunately, because I have so many scars all over my body, refinanced with long-term loans, everything we own, so we're not caught in the current interest rate debacle, and our occupancies are good. We have a great team of people who work hard every day to keep the places clean and full and well-maintained, and life is good. I got started in the business utterly by accident. I had some experience with property. My father worked for the government. He got a job during the Depression when his dairy farm went broke because the bank closed. But he was always an entrepreneur at heart. And we always had rent houses and ran cattle and did things on the side. So I was a unpaid farmhand and maintenance person and tax preparer for the old man. So I had some experience and a tool belt. And but I went off to college and graduate school and ended up in the Navy. And when I got out of Vietnam, I got a flat in San Francisco with a friend of mine from high school and a corporate job, which was boring and low paid. And my flatmate had gotten himself upside down in a little real estate rehab deal. He'd met some hippie in a saloon who talked him into buying a pair of Victorian flats for a fix-up, as San Francisco was gentrifying after its flight to the suburbs. And but not much work was going on, and my flatmate was afraid he was going to lose his little inheritance in this deal. And I said, well, if you pay me $3 an hour, I'll strap on my tool belt and help you finish the rehab so you can sell this sucker and get your money back. And after that, he and I went into business and did a couple of little rehab deals. And then I got married, and my wife was pregnant a few months later. That's the way we used to do it in the old days, get married, then get pregnant. You know, I realize that's horribly obsolete.
That's so old-fashioned.
Old-fashioned, yes. Antique. In any event, I then went to the headhunters looking for a job and ended up working for a national development company, the D.H. Overmeyer Company, based in New York City. Office on 42nd Street, right near Trump's rehab hotel, which used to be the Commodore. They built and operated warehouse buildings all over the United States, and some in Europe and some in Canada. And And the reason I took that job is I didn't know a warehouse from a whorehouse, but I figured, you know, for $18,000 a year, which was more than anybody else offered me, I could learn the business. And
you know the difference now?
Yes, I can. Well, part of my Navy experience and my Overmeyer experience taught me the difference between those two things. So, I then spent 35 years building, buying, selling, financing, managing, and leasing warehouse buildings, and ultimately all around the United States, Mexico, Japan, Singapore. You know, I was a warehouse king, and I lasted 3 years at all three and I, yeah, about 3 years at Overmeyer, and was promoted very rapidly because they were in process of going broke. Dan had gotten himself way over levered and owed everybody money, and so nobody stayed on the payroll very long. And within a year, I was the branch manager of both the San Francisco and Reno branches, running 1.5 million feet of warehouses, including 400,000 feet of what we used to call public warehouse. It's now called third-party logistics, but forklifts, racks, pallets, all that kind of thing. So
can I stop you there, Luis, and ask a question? It seems like earlier in your career, you were focusing on something. You were focusing on warehouse. And it seems like later in your career, you got a few different kinds of things, all in real estate, but a lot of different kinds of things going on. Now, one of the things I advise people on this podcast and elsewhere is that people should, even if they're going to be in real estate, is they should focus on an area of real estate that they can get really good at, because it's hard to be good at self-storage and hard to be good at low-income housing and, you know, regular multifamily housing and strip malls, because the numbers are always different in all those things. So how would you take what you do and maybe either disagree with that advice that I give or support it?
I would amplify that advice as much as possible. So early on in my career, I did small scale multifamily in San Francisco, and I continued with that business throughout. Even when I was working in the warehouse business, I always had a few little apartment deals in San Francisco. I got to know the city block by block, and I focused on just a couple of districts where there were middle and working class housing, focused on stuff that was beat up, focused on the kinds of rehab work that scared other people. So I bought a couple of buildings where the foundations had partially collapsed. And interestingly enough, it's an easy thing to cure. You go run a couple of screw jacks and jack it up 1/8 of an inch a day and pour a new foundation under it. But 99.9% of people looking at buildings are scared of it. Sure. Kind of in a micro way, I looked at little apartment buildings, some of which I still own today. And in the warehouse business, it's a pretty simple business, 4 walls and a roof, 4 feet off the ground. But until I retired from Prologis, I probably knew more about warehouse space than almost anybody on earth, because I'd been doing it for 35 years and met all kinds of tenants and all kinds of locations and knew people that were the users. We had conferences for users. I knew all the lenders. So, you know, I was deeply involved, and I could look at a site or look at a building. And I was on the investment committee at AMB. And every time one of our acquisitions guys who would buy anything that didn't move tied something up, I'd get on a plane and go look at it. And, you know, almost instantly I could tell what the defects in the building were because I had looked at so many buildings. And, you know, as an example, I looked at probably 150 buildings that we thought about buying in Mexico. In every single building, if you look hard enough, there's a shrine to Our Lady of Guadalupe. So that's how you distinguish a Mexican warehouse, is the Guadalupe shrine. In any event, yes. So, and my partner and I have done different things, but the first thing we look at anytime we're doing something is to know we're going to pay a stupid tax. Because there is always something that you didn't think about when you go into a new business. So when I went to Mexico, I didn't go buy buildings in Mexico or build buildings in Mexico. I went to Mexico to find a partner. And because I knew nothing about Mexican real estate or Mexican politics. And I ended up with a partner who was very good at Mexican politics and didn't know squat about the warehouse business. So I said, okay, here's the trade. You teach me how to build in Mexico and I'll teach you how to build a warehouse. And that's where we ended up. So when we did our first big industrial park, the president of Mexico showed up for the ribbon cutting ceremony, which is my idea of having good political influence. And and as an example, the first building I built in Mexico, we're building a 1,000,000-foot building for Procter & Gamble. You know, how can you go wrong? So, you know, we got a piece of land and I got my partner straightened out on how we had to rearrange the land purchase to get the right piece and you know, how to go about doing a build-a-suit document and all that stuff. Well, I come to find out there's no title insurance in Mexico. Well, who would have thought? So I had to hire lawyers to trace the title back to the cooling of the earth because I couldn't get title insurance. You know, and it turns out that you have to build your own storm drain all the way to the nearest river. It turns out you have to bring your electricity from the main power line all the way to your building. It turns out there's nobody to test the quality of your concrete, so you got to build your own testing lab. So, you know, I learned a lot of things about building in Mexico that had never occurred to me. And at one point, you know, I'm beating on my partners to follow all the rules, which they disregard entirely because I'm dealing with Procter & Gamble. And I'm thinking, you know, somebody's going to check everything. I got to have all the paperwork right. And at one point, my Mexican partner calls me up and he says, well, our permit isn't quite right. Our permit only calls for a building that's 28 feet clear. And since we were building a building that was 32 feet clear, I said, that's a real problem. You know, what does it cost to get the right permit? And he said, well, it'll be about $300,000. And I said, fine, I will wire you the money. You get the permit and send me a copy because $300,000 is a lot of money, but it's a rounding error in the context of this deal. And he said, well, no, it doesn't actually work that way because if we just pay half of the money, we'll go to the federal government and the state government is actually looking for money to build a gymnasium so the kids have a place to play basketball after school. And I said, fine, so you're telling me that the cost of the permit is a gymnasium. Is that what you're telling me? And he said, yes. And I said, fine, talk to the contractor and get me a bid for the gymnasium. You know, and not what I expected, shall we say. So the answer to your question is yes in spades.
Got it. Okay, well, so that brings us to today. And so, you know, you've got a lot of experience. So I want to jump to maybe giving advice or tips or techniques or strategies. You've written a couple of books. What do you suggest to people that want to make their way or continue their way in real estate? You know, what are some of the tips and strategies that you would suggest?
So first, you've got to make an analysis of yourself. So does the idea of unplugging a toilet or standing on the doorstep to collect rent or going to eviction court, bum you out? Then, you know, don't get into the real estate business because you're going to do all of that stuff. Yeah. Are you a really good analyst? Then maybe instead of being in physical real estate, you want to invest in REIT stock or maybe you want to invest with an entrepreneur who is doing real estate as opposed to hammering the nails yourself. You know, are you handy with your hands? You figure out what you're about and what rings your bell. So, you know, I actually like to do maintenance work. And for years, my son now runs my apartments and he hires everything out. I had a truck and a hammer and I wasn't very good at it, but I did it because number one, I enjoyed the satisfaction of getting something done. And number two, I'm cheap. So you got to figure out what you're like before you start. And the second thing is start small, find some little thing to do, try it out, see if you like it, see if you're any good at it, see if it gives you a sense of satisfaction, see if you're making any money at it. And then if you are, try and do some more. And once you get good at that, you may want to try something bigger or something a little different, but go one step at a time, go small, take your time and learn it as you go, and run around, seek all the advice you can, talk to people who've done it before you, and be teachable. And you can make money in REITs, you can make money in private equity, you can make money back at an entrepreneur, but first you got to know about you.
Got it. That's good advice there.
Hey, it's Mark Yeagy here to tell you about our Cash Flow Machine trading program that's designed to teach you how to make safe, reliable income. Now, we shoot for 2 to 4% a month of income and growth in your portfolio. And we have courses to teach you how to do this yourself or inside a mastermind community. And the best part of that is it only takes about 20 minutes a week to implement. Now, while 2 to 4% a month doesn't sound like much, I show you exactly how we took my IRA from $111,000 to over $500,000 in just 19 months without huge risk. I'm not telling you this to brag, just to show you that you could do this too. So to learn more about this program, go to cashflowmachine.io. That's cashflowmachine.io, and you can learn more.
As a lot of people go into real estate, they don't realize that real estate can also come down to numbers, right? So how do you recommend people learn the appropriate numbers for the business that they're considering?
Well, number one, the best advice I can give you comes from my former boss, Hamid Bogadam, who's the chairman and CEO of Prologis. He says, big money in real estate is made by those who have cash when nobody else does. So that's, you know, that's the ability to find the right deal and have the horsepower to close it when the time is right, because you make most of your money when you buy. If you buy wrong, you have a hard time ever making money in real estate. That's kind of a start. The second thing is, I think the worst thing that ever happened to the real estate business was the personal computer, because it allowed people to calculate an IRR and do sensitivity analysis. So when I was first buying buildings, it was really simple. I was working with a brokerage firm that set up a way for me to buy beat up buildings with a 10% down payment. The broker had a deal with an SNL guaranteed an 85% first, and on beat up buildings, the broker could convince the seller to carry a 15% second. So I'd come up with 10% of the money, and the SNL would give me a first, and the broker, if he had to foreclose on his guarantee, would own the building for 85 cents on the dollar, and you know, everybody was happy. And my calculation was, I had to have enough cash flow from the building to get my my investment, my 10% back in 2 years, so I could buy the next building. You know, that was the grand total of my calculation. How much cash flow will I get? And then I would go in and paint and carpet and some new appliances and raise the rent and get some cash flow, and I was okay. Now we got IRRs, you know, and an IRR is a very complex calculation that can easily be summarized by saying, take your going in cap rate, add your growth rate, and that's your IRR. That's a 47 column spreadsheet, but that's all there is to it. And then you back off for your turnover costs, and that's all there is to it. But, and I recommend that people consult a financial analyst or learn how to do an IRR, but do two things. Do it on the back of the napkin or the envelope, and do it on the spreadsheet and see if the two numbers match. And if they don't, one of them's wrong. Start over again. Yeah. And the second thing is, and the most important thing is, you need to figure out the risk reward ratio. So let us say I'm buying a building at Main and Main, leased to a creditworthy customer on a long-term lease, with at market rates, with cost of living escalators, in a building that is easily reusable for the next tenant. So, you know, let's say I buy that building at a 5% return. And let's say in the old days, I could get a 4% loan on a credit deal like that. So I get a 50% loan and I'm getting a 6% return on this deal. Well, that's 200 or 300 basis points above the 10-year treasury. And I got some tax shelter, so that's quite a reasonable deal. Like, you know, I'm making a leveraged return of 6% on this deal. Happy camper, sleep at night, no sweat. Now, let's say I'm buying a pool hall in Barstow, which doubles as a meth lab. And I'm going to have to hire a bodyguard to collect my rent. And if the meth lab gets busted, the pool hall isn't going to be able to pay its rent. I need a 25% return on that deal because of the risk and the work I'm going to go to collect the money. So if the pool hall lasts 4 years, I got 100% of my money back and everything else is gravy. So, you know, it's risk reward. So in every deal you're looking at, how much risk and how much work. So if you buy a low income rentals, which I own, you get a very high rate of return, but with a very high level of work. You have a lot of troublesome tenants. You have a lot of trash units. You have a lot of visits from the coroner and the police. It's a real pain to manage. You got a lot of regulatory crap to go through. You got bloodbath evictions, all of that stuff, but the rate of return is very high. If I buy luxury rentals, then, you know, I don't have much work, but I don't make much return. So you need to make that choice along the way and say, what is the appropriate rate of return for the job I'm entering into? And the other thing is that when you look at the pro forma, don't believe a word of it. You need to dig in and find out what the real expenses are and what the real rents are and what the concessions are and what the credit risks are and what the surcharges are. And you need to look at the actual bills and the actual receipts to figure out what's going on so you can figure out what the real numbers are as opposed to what the broker put down on the pro forma. Does that answer your question?
It does. So I want to shift gears here because I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about negotiation. And we don't have a lot of time to get into it. I've written a negotiation book as well called Negotiate to Win-Win. There's a lot of real estate examples in it. But from your experience, what are a couple of things that we can maybe just take away in a very brief discussion here about negotiation in real estate?
So my mantra is, he who cares least wins.
That's true.
Also works for she. She who cares least wins. So I attempt to enter every negotiation with an attitude of indifference. If the deal makes, fine. If it don't make, fine. I attempt to enter every deal with a list of what I need from the deal and what I'd like from the deal in kind of descending order of importance. If I can get what I need and a little of what I like, walk out the door, sign the paper, smile, tell the other team what a grand job they did, worry not about winning or losing, and walk on down the hall. If I can't get what I need, the answer is, gosh, folks, I don't think there's a deal here. It's been a pleasure to talk to you, and I don't want to waste anybody's time, and walk out the door and keep walking. And quite often you'll get called back, but the attitude of I don't give a rat's ass whether we do this deal or not unless I get what I need will get you a whole lot more deals than, oh God, I need this deal, or I, oh God, I have to win, or God, I have to look good. And so it ain't win-win. It ain't I win, you lose. It's I get what I need or I'm out of here.
Yeah, it's developing that walk-away power in negotiation is so critical.
It's the indifference is the ultimate power, and indifference walks three steps ahead of you as you enter the negotiation. If I'm projecting that I don't care, then I got you. And if you're projecting I need this deal, I definitely got you.
Yeah, for sure. Doubling up on that. Okay, well, cool. Listen, you've written a few books. Let's talk briefly about how people can get a hold of you or the books or get a little bit of more of Luis Belmonte in their lives.
Well, you can send me an email, lbelmonte@7hp.com. That's the number 7. And I'm happy to answer questions. I'm semi-retired. And you know, if somebody wants to send me a question, then I'm happy to try and answer it. If somebody wants to send me something to hustle me, it goes into the junk pile. And I've got a way to eliminate junk now where the whole page disappears. So In terms of books, everything's on Amazon. It's on Kindle or paperback. It's cheap. Real Estate 101 is basically a little description starting with how to go about buying a house to apartments, industrial, retail, office, all of it, just kind of the basics of each category of real estate and kind of what institutional real estate is all about, what pension funds invest in, what private equity invests in, how to deal with those kind of things, the property pyramid, that kind of thing, which is based on my association with institutional investment management for some considerable period of time. Street Dog MBA is basically about lessons learned. You know, things that have happened to me in the business world, starting with a paper route when I was a very young man, and the lessons I learned about collection. And so I tell a story and then say, this is what I think I learned as a result of that experience. And the basis of that is I used to be a guest lecturer at the Stanford Business School. And so what I tried to bring to that class was to tell the students from around the world things about the business world that I didn't think they'd learn in graduate school that might bite them in the ass when they got out into the real world. So one of the big examples was analytical skills. So you're going to learn in 2 years here how to do very sophisticated analysis, but you need to understand that most analysis is ex post facto rationalization for decisions already taken. So the poobah gets an idea and then they come to you and say, run the numbers. Try and figure out the answer the poobah wants to hear. And if the answer your numbers gives you is different, decide how much political capital you want to spend pushing your numbers and just make that decision. You know, so that kind of stuff. My negotiating book is about the attitude of indifference. I'm about to publish a book on management. And my premise there is that when you're a manager, you're not the boss, you're a servant of the organization, and your reward comes with appropriate service. So service first, reward second, not the other way around. So that's kind of the premise of the stuff I'm trying to put out in my books.
Beautiful. Well, listen, thank you so much. I'm sure we could talk a long time about all the different scars that you've got.
I got scars, yes.
But let's wrap it up. I want to thank you for your time, your wisdom, and also your service. Again, thank you for being a guest here on the Wealth Architect Podcast. Appreciate your time.
You got it. Thanks very much. A pleasure to talk to you.
And everybody else who's listening and watching, remember what I always say, never give up your power in your health, your wealth, or your time. I'll see you next time on the Wealth Architect Podcast. Take care.
You've been listening to the Wealth Architect Podcast with Mark Yeagy. Follow us on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Like and subscribe on YouTube. Share and tell your friends. See you soon.